Thank you to Neil as well for inviting me. I think I did, actually. Is that... Yeah, okay. I'm just speaking extra quietly. So I understand the audience is fairly varied, so I'm apologizing in advance to experts in interoperability and so on who are sitting here. And I'm going to talk about something which dates back quite a long way now in some ways, and from some points of view looks like a bit of a mathematical curiosity. But I think I'm sort of justified in talking about it again in some ways because it's a little bit of a sort of toy example of some things which are coming to prominence very recently. So work that people like Pedro, Juan Malvasima and so on are doing actually end up touching on some of the same ideas. And it's all about some curious intersections between the mathematics which is involved in solving problems in rather different areas of mathematical physics and whether one can sort of make some money, make some profit out of the intersections between these. So the rough plan of what I'm going to say, so I promise two spectral problems. I mean, there are now some further examples of this which aren't solvably spectral problems, this whole phenomenon. But, I won't talk about those, really. So the first spectral problem is to do with what happens in the world of integral models, and in particular, lattice models of statistical mechanics. So I'll talk a little bit about that, because I won't assume people know about that. But there's a whole raft of mathematical techniques which have been developed. And, well, I'll put some names up in just a second. Maybe I'll put them up now, actually. People like Baxter are the key names to remember and Google for in that area. Techniques for finding exact answers to certain rather non-trivial questions in terms of the behavior of certain models of toy models of magnets and that sort of thing. Okay? And the second spectral problem is even older, actually. It's just to do with an eigenvalue problem for an ordinary differential equation, which looks a bit like Schrödinger's equation. The one I'll actually concentrate on because it's a bit more exciting. Doesn't look like a slightly strange Schrödinger equation, because actually it's a non-Hermitian problem. And that's one interesting spin-off of the work that I'm going to talk about. Now, if I get at that point, there'll be a sort of little bit of a junction. So depending on how the time's going, I might talk about a little sort of more technical thing to do with things called minimal models, which are certain sorts of scale-invariant quantum field theories which arise in the integral model context, and how that relates to aspects of the way differential equations behave via something called the McNugget problem. But I usually don't get time to talk about that, so people can ask me about that later if they want to. The alternative is I might talk a bit about how one proves reality properties for these spectral problems. That's slightly fewer transparencies, so I'll see how the time is going. Anyway, that's the general thing. And the names that you should remember about this, so really the work that we did was joining together one and two rather than actually inventing anything inside one or two. Okay, so as I said, Baxter is kind of the key guy for area one. And then a bunch of Shibuya is a pure mathematician who was interested in the general property of eigenvalue problems of ordinary differential equations. And then people like Andre Voros, Daniel Bessis and Jean Justin, and Carl Bender, and the collaborator called Botcher, were involved in studying problems in the set two to start with. Okay, so that's the general drift. So first of all, I'm going to try and talk about some of the problems that people study when they're studying integral models. Okay, so integral models are more trendy nowadays because they're perhaps linked with string theory, although there are links with string theory. They're very well aware, but I'm not going to talk about that. I'm just going to talk about the very basics. Okay, so the simplest example, which will actually be directly relevant to what I'm talking about today, is something called the six vertex model. So you imagine that you have a square lattice, a square 2D lattice, okay, and you scatter arrows on the links of that lattice. So if you talk about the Ising model, you might think about a little spin that was pointing up and down on each vertex of the lattice. Okay? It's a bit different. You put your variables, your fluctuating variables, on the links of the lattice instead. Okay, but they're just little arrows that can just point left or right or up or down. And it's a generalization, or it comes inspired by something rather classical thing called square ice. So you have a sort of model of so ice, H2O, so you've got two hydrogens for every oxygen. And it turns out the way ice behaves is that you don't quite know which hydrogen is going to be associated with oxygen, except that each oxygen is going to have two hydrogens near it and two far away. Okay, so if the sort of connectivity of your lump of ice was actually in two dimensions, it has got the correct coordination number for real ice, it's just in two dimensions, not three, then you'd have a setup like this, where even at zero temperature, there'd be a little bit of residual entropy in the whole system, because you could move these hydrogen atoms around, as long as you always kept too near and too far to each oxygen. Okay? So you can sum up that by drawing little arrows towards where the hydrogen is on each link. And then the ice rule, which I just said in terms of too near and too far here, translates into saying that the flux of arrows through each vertex has to be conserved. Okay? So you have two in and two out from each vertex. So that's the ice rule We're going to only look at configurations of these things satisfying that rule. Okay, so that means that you have only... Whoops. I didn't do that. Come on, do it. So you have, in fact, six possible vertices according to that rule, which is why it's called the six vertex model. Okay, and a simple question that was first answered exactly... So a simple question that you could ask, not a question, just a bit of an aside really, is just how many possible configurations of arrows on an n by n lattice are there? Because once you start putting some arrows, you've got to conserve the flux of the arrows, so you don't have total freedom to put the next lot of arrows in, and so on. Okay? And the answer, it's a sort of good statistical mechanical question. It's called, if you want to look at the Leibniz paper about this, it's called, the paper's titled The Residual Entropy of Square Ice. So when you cool ice down to absolute zero, there's still a little bit of entropy in the system. And the answer is that it goes like some number to the power of the number of vertices, if that's our style of quantity. And Leib calculated that that number was actually exactly equal to, in this limit when the lattice gets very big, 4/3 to 3/2. If you look it up on Wikipedia or wherever, it's called Leib's number. So if you want to do something, you can put your name on a number, that's very good. And just sort of to get an understanding about this, if there hadn't been the ice rule, then you'd have, each edge has two options, so you'd have 2 to the number of edges, which is 4 to the n times n. So that would have given you W=4. Okay, so this ice rule is restricting things quite a lot. Actually, in 1935, Pauling had the clever idea of just considering this rule locally. So there you have 6 out of 16 of the local vertices are allowed. And so that would correct this 4 to 4 times 6 over 16. So you get 1.5 for W, which is actually quite a good guess. And in fact, it's closer to the value for real ice than the exact answer. So anyway, exact solvability does for you sometimes. Anyway, it's better to have an exact answer to the wrong problem than a better answer to the right problem. But okay, so anyway, that was kind of background and motivation and so on. We're now going to sort of leave behind any real world thing for a while. And just describe to you a little bit part of how Leib did the calculations. I'm certainly not going to go through all of the calculations, but a key ingredient of what he did was to use a technique known as the beta ansatz, which I'm sure people have heard of. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what the beta ansatz is. The first thing we're going to do, a theme in a lot of this is that actually if you complicate the problem a little bit, it gives it a bit more structure and makes it easier to solve. Okay? So we're going to ask for something a teeny bit more complicated, and a computer weighted sum, where depending on the particular vertices that are in our configuration, we assign a different weight to that configuration. Okay? So now it's a bit more like a standard statistical mechanics problem. So you ask for what the partition function is, which is a sum over all the possible configurations of the relative probability of that particular configuration. If you think of the product of all the vertices of these things called local Boltzmann weights, and if you allow yourself to suppose that things are symmetrical under a global flip of all the arrows, then there's going to be 3 parameters now in my model. Okay? And if you put all those 3 parameters equal to 1, then z is equal to the number that Leib was trying to calculate. Okay? So we're going to try and compute this in some limit. One approach to doing that is to start off by computing a transfer matrix. So you perform this sum just over all the sites horizontally across your lattice. Okay, so all those betas are going to be spins pointing forwards or backwards. So we're going to sum over all of those for a given set of spins going up into it and sort of out from it at the top. Okay, so that's going to give me a matrix with 2 to the n by 2 to the n entries for every possibility for the in indices and the out indices. Although, of course, it will have certain block structure because of the ice rule. So I'm not going to worry about that too much. And let's say we have periodic boundary conditions, something sort of wrapped things around here. Okay? And then, if you think about how matrix multiplication works, it's very obvious, then if you take the trace of t to the n, then you've actually computed the sum that you wanted to compute. Okay? So the partition function is given as the trace of t to the n. And if you want to compute these sorts of thermodynamic quantities that StatMet people are interested in, then you just need to know the large n behavior of the largest eigenvalues of t. Okay? Because that will dominate the behavior of z. And so, for example, for this square ice problem, if we know what the largest eigenvalue is doing, then we can get W out from that. Okay, so computing eigenvalues of this 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix is what the problem has reduced to. Because you can compute other quantities for these things too, like correlation functions and so on, but this is a start of what we want to do. So the problem that we started with has turned into diagonalizing a 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix. Okay, That's still rather hard to do. I mean, in practical situations, I mean, you know, these numbers grow very big, so just shoving it straight on the computer and looking at it isn't very practical. And you can think of the beta ansatz, this is all I'm going to say about the beta ansatz, really. You can think about the beta ansatz as a way of making a clever guess as to what these eigenvalues might be. Okay? So you start off with something which is kind of rather obviously an eigenvector, like all spins up, for example. It's kind of clear that that's going to be an eigenvector. It's just not the eigenvector you want. It's not the biggest eigenvalue. Okay? But then you can do certain little operations with sort of generalizations of raising and lowering, creation operators, essentially, to create other things which might be other eigenvalues, okay, other eigenvectors of that matrix. Okay? And those operations that you do on your sort of seed trivial eigenvector will depend on a number of real parameters. Okay? And these, in the trade, get called beta roots. Okay? So you can call these E0, E1, up to EK. Okay? And typically, for the thermodynamically important eigenvectors, there'll be about N of these. Okay? So before, we had 2 to the N things to fix to get our eigenvector, we just wanted to diagonalize it by brute force. Okay? Now we're going to ask for N numbers instead of all the N numbers. Okay? But of course, that won't work for all values, and this matrix has only got a finite number of eigenvectors. So there's got to be some constraint. It turns out there are exactly, well, this is K plus one of them, so there are exactly K plus one equations that have to be satisfied by these things. So you basically make your guess as the eigenvector. You substitute it in, see what you get, and you get the eigenvector, the would-be eigenvector back, plus a bunch of junk. And you have to set the coefficients to the junk equal to zero to make sure it's a true eigenvector rather than not an eigenvector. Okay? And the coefficients of that junk are basically sort of this plus, the left-hand side of this plus one, if you like. Okay? I'm giving a slightly cartoon version of it. Okay? So the coefficients of the bits of junk you need to vanish in order for your guess to be a good eigenvector turn out to be given by these sorts of equations. And so in order for it to be an eigenvector, you must have this set of k plus 1 equations in these k plus 1 unknowns to be satisfied. Okay? So they're a bit complicated. They're sort of coupling all of these different parameters together in a rather complicated way. So you see I fix j, and then it's got to talk to all of the other. So ej has to talk to all of the other eis in a specific way. Okay? Where this parameter q that appears here, well, typically it will be a pure phase for the cases I'm interested in. But it depends on some slightly complicated but known way on these parameters A, B, and C, which gave me my Boltzmann weights that specified the problem I was first interested in. Okay? So I'm going to have a bunch of k plus 1 equations and k plus 1 unknowns. And if you run through the possible values of k and then look at all the solutions of this, the idea is that that gives you you hope at least it gives you all the eigenvectors of this matrix, or at least all the thermodynamically important ones. Okay? There's some question of completeness of this, but we won't worry about that either for now. Okay? And there are, so I've glossed over a lot of stuff like 3B is not quite 1 on the right-hand side, but if we take a scaling limit, it is, and this sort of thing. Okay? But I really just want to give the general idea for the moment. Okay? So this has helped quite a lot, okay? And it only works, essentially, because of this sort of secret integrability of the model, which I haven't really spoken about. Okay? So it's a big improvement, and even if you just then try and solve those equations. So, by the way, that set of equations I wrote down there, those are called beta ansatz equations. So if you see in seminars people talking about beta ansatz equations, that's the sort of thing that they mean. And they're bunches of constraints which allow you to diagonalize these big matrices. Okay? But there's actually, it turns out to be a very neat reformulation of this. So we still sort of a little bit fiddly because we've got to solve for all these different, you know, these k plus 1 different numbers separately. Okay? And Baxter, back in the early 70s, actually what he was trying to do was solve a more complicated version of the six-vertex model where you also allow these arrows to have sources and sinks. You add 2 more vertices when they're all coming together or all going apart. Okay, and that's called the 8-vertex model. And at the time he was looking at it, the beta ansatz solution to that was not known. But he found he could reformulate the 6-vertex model in a different way, which from the 6-vertex model was equivalent to this beta ansatz solution, but also worked for the 8-vertex model. Okay? But for purposes of this talk, I'm not going to need that. But I'll just talk to you a little bit about how he reformulated the 6-vertex model. It needs one extra ingredient. This is another example of this idea that when you've got an integral model, you kind of want to use all the bits of structure that you can. Okay, so remember the 6-vertex model depended on 3 parameters, A, B, and C, and so far, there's only been 1 in the beta ansatz equation. And that would have been a bit of a clue that there was something slightly strange going on. Okay, so you could think of one of those A, B, and C, one degree of freedom from those, being just like the overall scale of the Boltzmann weight, which would factor out trivially from your partition function. But we still have one, in principle, non-trivial thing going on. Okay, so we have sort of 2-parameter set of things. And I've only used 1 parameter at the moment. And if I said that was kind of enough to determine anything, well, that's a little bit strange. And as I said, it's to do with the integrability of the model. And what you can do is you can wrap up the remaining non-trivial dependence in a second number, because we've got Q in the game already, which actually contains some physics, different values of Q, some models really are behaving in a different way. So we've still got one more degree of freedom left over, and I'll just call that zeta, or xi, or whatever that squiggle means, and that's called the spectral parameter. Okay? Spectral parameter are things which things kind of don't depend on, but are useful. Okay? So then this transfer matrix, okay, so I'll tend to work at fixed value of Q, okay, because that's the problem I want to solve, but I'm going to consider a whole lot of different values of xi at the same time. Okay? And you notice that xi didn't appear in the original, in the Bethe-Arnold equation. Well, here's why. Because this transfer matrix, it will now become a function of this xi. Okay? And Baxter showed that actually these things commute at different values of the spectral parameter. Okay? So this is another sort of good buzzword from instability. You say that these t's are then commuting transfer matrices. Okay. And that, what that means is that you can diagonalize them all simultaneously. Okay, for any all different values of what's generally a complex number psi, okay, you can diagonalize them all simultaneously. And we can focus on just a single eigenvalue. Okay. Let's call it T without the blackboard font. Okay. And the key feature of what that we've got from this is that it's an entire function of this parameter. And the reason for that is normally, I mean, if you have a matrix which depends on a parameter, then of course the eigenvectors will depend on that parameter too. And that means that if you take an eigen, if you continue a parameter, say, round a loop, it might be that some of the eigenvectors swap over. And that would give you a sort of branch point in your dependence of the eigenvalue on the spectral parameter. Well, on the parameter. And if it's a spectral parameter, that won't happen because the eigenvectors are all staying put. Okay, so the eigenvalue is just whatever you get when you hit that particular vector with this thing T of psi, and the entries of T of psi, well, I haven't written them down, actually depend analytically, single valuedly, on psi. Okay? So this is an entire function of psi. And what Baxter spotted is that the requirement that this T of psi, okay, this eigenvalue, follows, is an eigenvalue of the sixth vertex model, follows from solving all those Bethe-Arnold equations and then subbing in, then you know, getting the relevant eigenvector, and so on, is equivalent to demanding that there should be a second entire function. So we've got this unknown function t, and now we're going to add a further unknown function, q. Okay? But t and q together must satisfy this slightly strange relation. So green is a bad color. So t of psi times q of psi is going to be q of then this q, which was my sort of physics team parameter, to the minus 2 psi, plus q of q squared times psi. Okay? And this is sort of famous. It's known as the pq relation, back to the pq relation. And that's the thing which I'm going to try and reproduce in a different context later. Okay? Now, at first sight, this looks rather strange, because we start off with one unknown function, and now we've got two unknown functions, but we're saying that having these two functions is actually more constraining than we were before. And the reason is because both of these functions have to be entire. And you can see there's a risk that, for example, this equation here might imply that t has a pole. If q has a zero, okay, then if it's not matched by a corresponding zero of the right-hand side here, then we're going to get a pole in t. And that's not allowed, because t is an entire function. So it's entirety which is key. So let's just see that in action. I think I've got still time. So here's how TQ relations imply beta ansatz equations. And so, again, very standard in calculation. Okay. So I've got t times q is q plus q. I guess suppose my zero, so q is some entire function. Okay. The zeros of q are going to be at some points. Okay. I'm not going to say anything more about them. I'm going to call them E0 up to EK, though, even though at this stage I don't know it's got anything to do with beta roots at all. Okay? So then I can write Q as a product over those zeros, modulo some questions about how it grows at infinity, which I'll gloss over. Okay? And then the idea is you just put psi equal to one of those zeros of Q in that TQ relation. Okay? That's the risky situation for getting a pole in T. Okay? So in order for T not to have a pole, then the right-hand side of that equation has to vanish as well. Okay? We need q when we shift backwards from 0 of q, has to be minus q when we shift forward from 0. Okay? You just rearrange that, and you find that you get exactly the Bethe-Arnold equation. Okay? So what that tells you is that for t and q to satisfy the tq relation, the zeros of q have to talk to each other via the tq relation. And then it turns out that the formula that then gives you for what t has to be, that's got by dividing through there, is exactly the correct formula for the eigenvalue. Okay? Good. So that's one technique for solving these intermodals. It turns out that then these TQ relations can be transformed into things like integral equations and so on, and then solved relatively efficiently. That's one strand of this story. Okay. I'm just going to mention very briefly, I'm not sure I'm going to have time to get onto this further, but this whole idea of these sort of functional equations is very key in this whole game. And something else that gets mirrored when I come to spectral problem number two, which I'll just mention very briefly, is an alternative tactic which Baxter also introduced for solving these models, which is to start off with his basic transformatrix, the thing I want to diagonalize first, and then define a collection of things called fused transformatrices, relies on a bit of underlying group theory of these problems, and which also commute with your first transformatrix. You see that index J looks like sort of SU2 type index, if it's correct. It turns out these satisfy further functional relations, okay, with initial conditions. And these functional relations, that's known as the fusion hierarchy. Again, it's just a technical term which we don't really need to worry about. Subject to these little initial conditions, so this T half is actually the T we're really interested in. And in itself, that doesn't constrain this function T at all, because we just define an infinite function, further function. But it turns out that when Q is a root of unity, that series, that bunch of functions, you can show truncates. Okay, so once you've gone high enough up the tree, this T becomes equal to 1 again. And then you can get a closed set of equations which you can solve again. Okay, so that was all in the context of lattice models. I'll just mention, because it's going to come in later, that this whole machinery, so people have heard about two-dimensional conformal field theories and so on. This is another example of essentially two-dimensional systems which can be exactly solved. Okay, but these are continuum field theories. And originally, this was all done using the whole ideas of the Virasoro algebra, the infinite symmetry algebra there. But Bajanov, Lukyanov, and Zamolodikov, partly because they were interested in what would happen to these things when you lost conformal symmetry but preserved integrability, they realized that actually this machinery that Baxter had of T and Q relations, these functional relations, could be used also in this context. And they were able to define analogs of these T and Q operators directly in Hilbert spaces of conformal field theory, okay, which have specific central charges, which are characteristics of these theories. And then there's a certain relationship between the parameter Q that appears in the TQ relation and the central charge that crops up in the conformal field theory. Okay. And when truncation occurs, so when this set of fusion relations truncate, it actually corresponds to the situation where your conformal field theory is particularly simple and where the number of these things, well, there are things called primary fields, which are fields in the conformal field theory which transform particularly simply under Virasoro transformations. And when the set of the primary fields is finite, you have something called a minimal model, okay, at least when the central charge is less than 1. And this turns out to correspond to this truncation of this fusion hierarchy. And I may say a little bit more about that later, but I think, depending on how time is going, we'll see. Okay, so that's enough about integrability in general. I'm sort of, about halfway through, so that's good. So the sort of summary of that is that to solve these integral models, we really want to be diagonalizing these great big matrices. Okay, and the Baker Ansatz is just an inspired guess for how to diagonalize this matrix. And you can reformulate the constraints on your guesses in terms of sets of functional relations, which can either be this TQ relation or, if you want, this fusion hierarchy. And either way, you get closed sets of equations that you can then go ahead and solve. Okay? And so this is very special to integrability, of course. And that's how, in some sense, Lieb and so on got their exact answers from quantities of interest. And, well, there are various technical terms in terms of the sorts of equations that you get out, which I won't need. Okay, so now I'm going to shift gear completely and talk about a different set of spectral problems, which at first sight look, in some sense, more classical, although it looks a bit like quantum mechanics, to do with the behavior of ordinary differential equations. And I'm going to claim that these have something to do with the first set of problems in a way that I think is vaguely interesting. Okay. So I'm going to consider this rather non-standard version of a cubic oscillator. So cubic oscillators anyway look a little bit dodgy because they're potential. So you can try and think about, or unbounded below. So you can try and think of this as just an ordinary Schrodinger equation for a single particle moving in a one-dimensional potential. Okay, it's just the potential is minus ix cubed. A little bit non-standard. Okay, so the least. So what sense do we make of this? Well, actually, in some sense, some ways, this is mathematically easier and nicer than the problem if I didn't have the I. Okay, so minus x cubed behaves worse because you have these runaway solutions to minus infinity. Okay, we'll see why that's true in a minute. But anyway, that's a perfectly well-defined eigenvalue problem. Okay, I want the boundary conditions to be that my wave function, or well, maybe it's dangerous to call it a wave function, but anyway, this function psi, my eigenfunction, should decay to zero as x tends to plus or minus infinity along the real axis. Okay, I'm just asking for those values of e such that that is true. Okay, so if you start solving your differential equation out of x equals minus infinity with a decaying solution, and just try and track its behavior. Then for most values of E, you'll end up with a growing solution at plus infinity. That's not a good eigenvalue. Okay? But maybe if you're lucky, E will hit a particular value such that it's decaying again at plus infinity. And then you call that an eigenvalue. Okay? But it's non-emission. That's kind of important. Okay? And our claim is that it actually knows, in some sense, about these conformal field theories, these TQ relations and so on, at a particular point, okay, at a particular value of the parameter Q, or at a particular central charge, once you've used that dictionary I mentioned to you before, actually, minus 22 over 5. So we'll try and see where that comes from. Okay, but the initial question you might ask for this, and this is something that people like Carl Bender and so on got excited about, but was actually originally conjectured by, I think, Bessie's and Zander Stan. The question is, what's the spectrum of this like? Okay, it's a non-emission problem. Use your standard technique for proving things about the spectrum. They don't really work. But, well, maybe the spectrum is real anyway. And so Bessie's and Zander Stan in the early 90s, can't really find out exactly when, neither of them would commit, but anyway, sometime in the early 90s, conjectured that that did have an entirely real spectrum. Okay? So if you require the wave function to decay at plus and minus infinity, then E has to be real, necessary condition. Okay, and that was motivated by certain problems, actually, one dimension up, with things like what's called the Yang-Ling edge singularity and so on, problems with field mechanics. But it's actually surprisingly hard to prove. So if you're drifting off, then you can try and think about how to prove that just using standard methods. For example, in 2000, there was a proof using a sort of sum rule for the eigenvalues that any complex eigenvalues were constrained by this slightly curious formula. The real part of the eigenvalue divided by its modulus squared has to be less than 10 to the fifth. I think it excludes complex eigenvalues from a rather big circle. Okay, and then there's a bit more care that has been proved for 10 to the minus 16, okay, which makes the circle even bigger. Yeah, but it still wasn't sort of completely rigorously proved that the spectrum of that was real. So it's kind of a challenge to see how to prove that. So I'll talk about that a little bit later. Okay? But how are we going to handle that? Well, there are actually some relatively sophisticated techniques. These are inspired by ideas of Shibuya and then Andrei Voros and so on. And this is where these functional relations are going to crop up again. Okay? So this is going to be my bridge between this subject and the subject of the first half of my talk. So what we're going to look at is just analyze this equation in a little bit more detail. Okay? And since the boundary conditions are being imposed at plus and minus infinity, it's natural to look, first of all, at what the eigenfunctions of this look like. So this is kind of elementary stuff. Right? So we'll write the ordinary differential equation as this. So I'll define this sort of driving term here. So I'll consider E now as a parameter, and I won't restrict myself to eigenvalues for the moment. I'll just think about this equation at any value of E, okay, and look at the behavior of the eigenfunction. If X is large, okay, positive or negative, then it's a good approximation to write the WKB approximation for the wave function psi. It's a second order equation. There are two solutions that come with a plus or minus. And if you do the integral and look at the asymptotic term and so on, you get plus minus 2/5 times Ix to the 5/2 exponentiated. That's what the solutions look like, the plus or minus infinity. So here it is again, top of the screen. Okay. And you can see that as X goes to plus infinity, one of those solutions, actually, I can't in my head say which one, but one of them, because I to the 5/2 does have a non-zero real part, one of them is growing in modulus, and one of them is shrinking. And the technical term people use for that is to say that one is dominant and one is subdominant. And the subdominant one is actually kind of uniquely determined up to scale. The dominant one, of course, you could add in a little bit to the subdominant one, but we don't worry about that. And the same is true as X tends to minus infinity. So the eigenvalue is going to occur when my subdominant solution to the left continues and becomes the subdominant solution to the right. Okay? And generically, that won't happen. You'll have a bit of dominant solution as well on the right, and you won't be at an eigenvalue. But if E is such that it does, then you're okay. And the problem with all this analysis, well, also the thing which makes it possible to think about eigenvalues, is, of course, that the WKB approximation doesn't work in the middle region. So you can't just naively continue your solution across if that doesn't work. There's no free lunch. So what are the options? Well, one option, which is a standard textbook thing, is to use some sort of asymptotic matching. Okay, so you could try and match the places where WKB is breaking down. It's when your driving potential term, when there's that 1 over P and so on there, when that's got zeros. So you can try and continue through these zeros by matching onto airy functions, this sort of thing, which is a standard thing you do in a textbook about ordinary Hermitian eigenvalue problems. But for this one, since the problem is anyway non-Hermitian, it's more natural in some ways to enlarge your perspective and look at the solution of the whole complex plane first. Okay, and this will get us onto something called the Stokes phenomenon, which is important for what I'm going to do next. So I'm going to consider now solutions not just along the positive and negative real axes, but along an arbitrary direction off to infinity, okay, parameterized by an angle theta. Okay, so theta just the angle for the negative imaginary axis. Okay, and for rho, which is the distance from the origin, tending to infinity, WKB still works. Okay, so our solutions look like that, okay, where I've now got this extra little factor depending on theta that sums up how the thing is behaving. Okay, so that's what solutions look like. So here we go. So there's my ordinary differential equation on the top. Okay, and there's my WKB solution. And now here's a little paradox which is going to get resolved rather quickly, which is that for general reasons, there are theorems which say that solutions to my differential equation are entire, okay, functions of x. Right? So they're single valued. But if I look at my WKB solution, that thing with two stars on it, that's not single valued. If theta goes to theta plus 2 pi, go once round, I swap from the plus to the minus there. Okay? Even if I stay miles from the origin, okay, I said WKB was in trouble at the origin, but WKB should be a good approximation, a long way from the origin. So what's gone wrong? How is it that my WKB solution doesn't work? Well, the resolution is not that WKB is going wrong, but you've got to be careful that the continuation of an asymptotic is not always the same as the asymptotic of a continuation, from the buzzword. Okay? In other words, if I find the asymptotic and then continue the asymptotic, I don't necessarily get to the same function as if I go directly to the asymptotic in a new direction. Okay? And that's really called the fancy word for that, because this was discussed first by Stokes, is the Stokes phenomenon. So we'll talk about that a little bit, because it's kind of key to getting new functional relations. Okay, so you can see that it can't be that continuing this asymptotic gives us the right answer, because that would spoil single valuedness. Something must be going wrong. What's going wrong is the Stokes phenomenon. So, and the key to that is this idea that some solutions are dominating over others. So although naively we have these two solutions, growing and decaying ones, a decaying solution, if it's hidden underneath a growing one, can lose its identity. And let's have a little look at how that works. So we've got these two different solutions, psi plus and minus, which in principle are normally growing and decaying. Okay? And that, whether they're growing or decaying, is determined by this complex phase. It's e to the I times phi theta over 2. It's appearing there. And so long as that phase has a non-zero real part, then I'm in this good situation where I've got a growing solution and a decaying solution, okay, as rho tends to infinity. Okay? And in particular, that's true for my original eigenvalue problem on the real axis, which is why the problem is well posed. But if the real part of that complex phase is zero, okay, then both of these solutions are oscillating. Okay? That's not a good direction to go off to infinity. The subdominant and dominant solutions are swapping over. Okay? And if I'd not had that factor of I in my cubic oscillator at the beginning, then that would have actually occurred along the real axis. So it's associated with this direction out to infinity along with the solution sort of running away. Okay, that's kind of bad news for eigenvalue problems. We don't like that much. Okay, but anyway, we obviously need to sort of think about what's happening on those lines if we're going to get a clue what's going on. And the sort of technical term, well, actually scholars differ, but I think Michael Berry, and I think it actually lines up with what Stokes himself used. He didn't call these lines Stokes lines. He called a certain other lot of lines I'll introduce in a moment Stokes lines. So these ones get called anti-Stokes lines, which is a little bit of a mouthful, but still. Okay, so I've got these lines which I've written in solidly there. Okay, which are the anti-Stokes lines. Okay, and these are the lines along which solutions dominant and subdominant swap over. Okay, so now, although I started off with a cubic oscillator, you've always got to sort of jump by two, because we did an integral when we did the WKB. So that sort of leapt us from sort of 3 to 5, roughly what's going on. So we've split up the plane into these 5 slices of pi. Okay, within each slice, within each these are now called Stokes sectors between these things, is another fancy word. So there are 5 sectors of the complex plane. And within any single sector, if we head off to infinity, we've got one solution which is growing and one which is decaying. Okay? And on these solid lines, those are swapping over. And that's potentially causing grief. And in particular, within each Stokes sector, if you go bang down the middle of the Stokes sector, which is now my dotted line in that picture, then the dominance of the dominant solution over the subdominant solution is maximal. Okay? Because it's sort of growing, it's e to the plus real number and e to the minus real number. Okay? So in terms of the asymptotic, you're actually free to change the coefficient of the subdominant solution by anything you like in terms of getting the right asymptotic, because it's completely swamped by this growing solution. So as long as the coefficient of the growing solution is non-zero, you're free to change. There's no mathematical contradiction if, as you then continue round, so in the theta degree of freedom, you change your coefficient of subdominant solution each time you pass a dotted line. Okay? And that's actually what happens for the real solutions of the equation. And that's the phenomenon that Stokes discovered, called the Stokes phenomenon, and that's how single-validedness gets restored. Okay? If you start off, say, with a solution which is actually only subdominant, so say if in S0 I started off with a decaying solution, well then I can't change the coefficient on in front of the decaying bit of the solution, because there's nothing to hide it. Okay? But once I've moved then from S0 round to S1, the decaying solution has continued into a growing solution. Okay? And naively, the coefficient on the solution which decays in S1 is now zero, right? Because otherwise it would have continued back to be a growing solution in S0. Okay? But then as I continue past the dotted line in S1, there's no inconsistency in now assigning a non-zero coefficient to the decaying solution in S1, because that hasn't changed the final asymptotic, which is all I was going to calculate. Okay? So there's no discontinuity in the asymptotic. And of course that makes no difference. But then by the time I get to S2, the growing and decaying solutions are swapped round again. Okay? And now it has made a difference. And that's actually what does happen to the real solutions in S2. Okay? And in particular that restores single validedness. Okay, so how do we handle that? I mean, now obviously the challenge of finding eigenvalues. So what we want to know, of course, is that if we take, say, a decaying solution in S minus 1, so a subdominant one there, and then we continue that solution around, is it again a decaying solution in S1? Okay? Naively, it would be, because we go decaying, then it'd be growing, and then it'd be decaying again. So naively, if we just take the continuation of the WKB asymptotic, we're fine. But of course, sneakily, there could be a little coefficient on the S0 decaying solution here creeping in, which then turns into a growing solution in S1 and stops us being at an eigenvalue. Okay? So what we need is a handle on how these coefficients are being generated. And these are things, the things we need to calculate are basically things called Stokes coefficients, which describe how these discontinuities arise as we go around. Okay. Now, that's a neat way of doing all of this, a very sort of mathematically streamlined way of doing it, which was developed by Shibua, I think, and a rescaling trick, which I think Shibua knew all about, but Simancic used in other contexts when he was looking at harmonic, well, anharmonic oscillators and so on, so sometimes gets called Simancic rescaling. So, let's do this. So here's our differential equation again. And now, in the case Stokes sector, okay, so I told you, say, if you had a decaying solution here, Y0, let's call it, it turns into a growing solution here and here. Okay? Because we're allowed to naively continue the WKB asymptotic that far, it doesn't make any difference to the asymptotic behavior. Okay, the Stokes phenomenon isn't going to mess things up. It's only if we try to continue further we'd be in trouble. So in the case Stokes sector, I'll let Y sub K of X and E be a solution which is subdominant in that sector. I'll talk about its normalization later. Okay, but Shibua proved a little theorem which said that actually there always was such a solution. Well, that's what we expect from the WKB asymptotics. And actually it depends in an entire, it's an entire solution which also depends on E in an entire fashion. Okay? And in fact, we know it's asymptotic in this sector and the two neighboring ones. In this sector, it's decaying. In these two sectors, it's growing in a way which is the continuation of the WKB asymptotic and is not being messed up by the Stokes phenomenon. Okay? So we know the solution in those three neighboring sectors, but we don't know what this solution does up here or up here. Okay? And likewise, we can define Y minus 1 and Y1. Okay, so I'm going to talk to you later in just a second about how we actually define these solutions. But let's just run with that for a moment. So we've now got these five particular solutions to our differential equation, solving this equation in these five different sectors. Okay. All right. What else can we know? Well, let's note that if we have two neighboring y's, say, let's say y0 and y minus 1, okay, those two solutions must be linearly independent, right? Because we actually have control over that asymptotic in a common domain where one is growing and one is decaying. So those two solutions must be independent. And since the differential equation itself is a second-order differential equation, they must be a basis to the set of solutions, the only two dimensional space of solutions. Okay? That means that we could, say if we take y0 and y1 to be our basic solution, then y minus 1, okay, we're kind of interested in the relationship between y minus 1 and y1, y minus 1 must be a linear combination of y0 and y1. So we must be able to write down a little relationship like that, that y minus 1 is some multiple of y0 plus some other multiple of y1. And these numbers, c and c tilde, which of course can depend on e, they don't depend on x, are called Stokes multipliers. And they're the things which control the way these solutions are sort of knitting themselves together as we go around. Then you can actually write a little formula for these two functions by taking Wronskian. Okay, so the Wronskian between two functions is a little anti-symmetric gadget, which is a constant if you've got two different solutions to the same equation, as we do here, okay, and vanishes if you take, it's anti-symmetric. So if we take the Wronskian of this thing, this whole equation with y0, then we kill off the c, which way around do I want to do? If I do it with y1, I'm going to kill off the c tilde curve, you can get a formula for c, and I take it with y1, y0, I kill off the c and get a formula for c tilde. Okay. And we can actually also use, because we know the WKB asymptotics of these solutions, when we've got yk and yk plus 1, they have an overlapping region. Okay, we can evaluate this Wronskian wherever we like, if it doesn't depend on where we're at. We can evaluate it at rho tends to infinity, and then we see that it's actually independent of E. Okay, so the nearest neighbor Wronskian is independent of E. And you can see that C tilde is only made up of nearest neighbor Wronskian. Okay, so we can normalize E such that these nearest neighbor Wronskians are equal to 1, so we normalize these Ys, such that these nearest neighbor Wronskians are equal to 1, and then it turns out that C is then just the Wronskian of Y minus 1 with Y1. I'll talk about the interpretation of that in a minute. And C tilde is just minus 1. So two nearest neighbor gadgets. So sorry about the sort of technicalities, but it's not that hard. And this is kind of neat, because now you see we've got y minus 1 is c, which is still this unknown function, which can depend on e, times y0, minus y1. Okay, and last, we're getting closer to what we want, because the Stokes relation can now be rewritten as c, which is the function of e, times y0 of x and e, which is this particular solution. Okay, is equal to y minus 1 of x and e plus y1 of x and e. Okay, and if you sort of remember back to the TQ relation said t times q is q plus q. So if you think about c as being a bit like t and y as being a bit like q, you've got something that sort of has a slight air of the TQ relation about it in this functional relation. There are two problems with that. Okay, first of all, we've got not just one function q, but y0, y minus 1, and y1. And also we've got x appearing. Right? The TQ relation only depended on E. Here we've got x as well. Now how do we get around that? Well, to get rid of k, we can use a little trick. So this is this rescaling argument that I said. It turns out, so if we think about our base, let's suppose that we've already figured out what y0 is. That's a solution which is decaying in sector S0. Okay. How would we naively make a solution which decayed in the next sector round? What you do is you just shift x, okay, by, if you want to go around k sectors, you shift it by omega to the minus k. If you do that variable change in your equation, so well, that doesn't quite work, and now the coefficients of the equation have changed. But actually, the only coefficient that does change, because omega is the fifth root of unity, is the coefficient of e in the equation. So we can compensate for that by shifting e as well. Okay? So it's an easy exercise to check that this is indeed a solution to the equation again, which solves the same differential equation, but is now subdominant in the kth Stokes sector, and so the naught one. So that's how we get rid of that, and this factor of omega to the k on 2 is there just to ensure that these Wronskians of neighboring solutions are equal to 1. Okay? So once I've done that, my little Stokes relation becomes c times y naught is y naught plus y naught. That looks more promising. Well, these phase factors I'll talk about in just a second. Right? Well, what about x? Well, that's easy. Let's just set x equal to 0. Okay? So if I set x equals 0, we just have naught here, naught here, and naught here. And I've got myself a relation which says that c of e times d of e is something times d of omega to the minus 2e plus something times d of omega squared e, okay? Where d is this function, this special solution y, at naught and the particular value of e. And that's exactly the six-vertex TQ relation. Okay, so that's kind of the main punchline of the talk, in some ways. Okay, at the particular value of Q, which is actually e to the 2 pi over 5, I think I've got it right. And the only thing that you'd be a bit suspicious of is these little factors of omega that have appeared at the top. Okay, the TQ relation I showed you before didn't have omegas, so those little phases, and they're just pure phases. Well, it turns out that they're natural for lattice models as well, because remember I imposed a periodic boundary condition on my system when I worked out T. Well, it turns out it's possible to keep these nice integrability properties but have a little sort of twisted boundary condition. And if you adjust the twist just right, then what comes out from the whole beta ansatz machinery is the same. Excuse me. The same as before, except these little phase factors. So we've come up against the same relation as we would have got by trying to solve a lattice model. And furthermore, both of these numbers, C and D, both of these functions, are actually spectral determinants. So why is that? This is going to be relevant. I think I'm going to talk about the reality property rather than the McNugget problem. I've only got 10 minutes left. So these numbers, C and D, are spectral determinants. And why is that? Well, C is a spectral term because it's the Wronskian between the solution y minus 1, which decays in this left-hand sector, and the solution y1, which decays in the right-hand sector. You know, if you remember about Wronskians vanish when solutions are linearly dependent. Okay? So if C vanishes, if we're at a value of E such that C vanishes, that means that Y minus 1 and Y1 are linearly dependent, which means if we take a solution decaying over here, which in particular includes the negative real axis, it's also decaying over here, which is the positive real axis. So zeros of C correspond to eigenvalues of my original sort of dodgy harmonic cubic oscillator problem. What about D? Well, D vanishes if and only if this function y0, which already decays at minus infinity along the imaginary axis, also vanishes at the origin. Okay? And that's what sometimes in the WKB business is called a radial spectral problem. And we could do a little variable change, and it basically corresponds to having a solution to an equation where E has got flipped to minus E, which decays. And if you do a variable change, you actually also eliminate. So if we rotate from here to the real axis, we'll get rid of that factor of I in my potential. So I now have minus d squared dx squared minus x cubed. The chalk is getting too small. Minus x cubed psi is, I think, minus e psi once we've done the variable change. And the boundary conditions would be that we decay at x equals plus infinity and at x equals 0. Okay? And that's a nice Hermitian spectral problem. Okay? So the zeros of D are actually all real numbers. Okay? But we've got two different spectral problems now associated with this rather simple differential equation, either this or the one with an I in it. Okay? And okay, so the two spectral problems are trivially related just by replacing x by ix and putting a different boundary condition on. We now know they're related to each other at a much more deep level via this functional relation, which is actually exactly the same functional relation as cropped up in Baxter's studies of the six vertex model. So that was kind of the excitement. So the sort of punchline to this part of the talk, which is almost all of it, is then to say that at this particular value of q, corresponding to the omega that I got, okay, which turns into q being 2 pi over 5, the T and Q operators that are defined by Baxter or, well, Bajanov, Lukyanov, and Zamlodnikov, who defined it in the conformal field theory context, are exactly encoding spectral data for this complex, well, this harmonic oscillator, anharmonic oscillator, and its sort of friend, Hermitian friend here. Okay, and if you unravel the little equivalences which give you values of central charge and so on, it'll turn out this corresponds to the particular value of C minus 22 over 5, which was what I claimed earlier. Okay, so given the time, I think I'll just mention quickly how you... So there are various applications of all of this. And I think I'll skip the McNuggets and just show you briefly how you can use this sort of technology to prove reality of the spectrum. Okay, so you've all now had half an hour since I posed the problem. So the question is, how do we know? So this problem's easy, right? This you can give to your undergraduates on a good day, and they know how to prove reality of this one because there's no factor of I, and you just multiply it. Maybe I'm optimistic. Anyway... That should work. Okay, but the one when I put some factors of I in, and then I was trying to solve the problem on this sort of funny contour, yes, I had the ix cubed potential. We've got much less control over that, okay? It's much harder. But now we ought to be able to exploit the fact that the eigenvalues of this problem are talking to the eigenvalues of that one. So how can we use that? Well, it turns out you can use it quite effectively. Okay, so I've written down at the top So these C's and D's are the same as the T's and Q's, but I'll stick with C and D for now. Okay, that's my functional relation, okay, which I was able to prove by fiddling around with these, elementary calculations. Actually, there's nothing particularly complicated, it's just to fall out neatly. And the zeros of this function C, right, that was the Wronskian of y minus 1 and y1, they're the eigenvalues of the non-Hermitian spectral problems. They're the ones that are a bit of a challenge. Okay? And I'll write C as an infinite product over those zeros. Okay? So that's the function which vanishes at all the right places and no wrong places. And okay, so I could worry about what C of 0 is, but let's not bother with that. And you can prove that there's no nasty growth at infinity, which you can prove that really is what the function looks like. Okay? And that product is indeed convergent. Okay, so I can write C like that. Okay, and then D, well, I did this little variable change, so I think it actually turns out to be the negated zeros of D of E are the eigenvalues of this Hermitian spectral problem I just drew on the blackboard here. Okay, so those are ones we like much better, we can control them. But again, I can write D as a product over those zeros. Okay, so now I've got D as an infinite product of 1 plus E over EI. I've got the signs confused. So we know lots about these little EIs. Okay, they're real, and actually they're positive as well. You can prove that. Okay, elementary level. Now let's consider. So when we derived the Bethe Andersen equation before, what we actually did was we considered this TQ relation, or CD relation, at a zero of D. Right, and that gave us an equation which made the zeros of D talk to each other. Okay? Now I'm going to do something different. I'm going to consider that relation at a zero of C. And that will make the zeros of the non-Hermitian problem talk to the zeros of the Hermitian problem, which is sort of nice. Okay. So if I'm at a zero of C, right, then again, the left-hand side is vanishing, so the right-hand side must also vanish. That means that this ratio of these functions D, which are infinite products over these little e's, that I know all about, when I evaluate it at a capital E, which is one of these eigenvalues of the non-Hermitian problem, have to satisfy this special little property here. So if I multiply everything out, I get this little infinite product here. Okay, so I've got the product of all of these things. And here we've got these little e's, which we know are all real and positive, and these capital e's, well, just one of them, in fact, which we don't yet know much about. Okay? One more page of this, and then we're done. The key trick is to take the modulus squared of that formula. Okay, and then you get a little formula like I've written at the top, okay, that mod squared of that thing, product, is equal to 1. Okay, because the right-hand side was a pure phase. And clearly that's fine if these E's were real, because then you just have something divided by its complex conjugate, which has unit modulus. Okay, so then we're quite happy. But if not, well, let's suppose that E is its modulus, so the capital E that we're not sure about yet, times little phase, E to the I delta. Okay, then the equation turns into this one here. Great. So this equation here, and all of these E's are positive. Okay. And if you think about it for a little bit, you'll realize that this term here, okay, does not depend on I, right? Because we've only got one EK here. And this term here, so this is just got by computing the modulus of this thing, does not depend on I. Okay. And since all of these little EIs are positive, okay, if the cosine on the top is bigger than the cosine on the bottom, then every term, it doesn't matter what the little EIs are or capital EK or capital EK is. Every term here is bigger than every term here. Right? And there's no way you can multiply infinitely many things bigger than 1 together and get something equal to 1. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And the same is true if cos of that is less than cos of that. Okay, then you're multiplying things that are less than 1. So the only way that this equality can hold is if cos of that is equal to cos of that, which is just that delta is equal to mortal pi. Okay? So the only way it can hold is if it holds in the rather trivial way that these E's are real in the first place. Okay? And that proves that the spectrum of that thing is real. Okay? So it's kind of quite neat that it works out so simply like that. And that actually, as far as I know, is still the only proof that the spectrum of that thing is real. And it's all come by techniques inspired by integral models. So now in just the last few minutes, I'll just mention various generalizations and so on of all of this. And then I'll skip the McNuggets and do some conclusions. So the whole thing generalizes in various ways. So the first thing we can do is that we can replace this ix cubed by a general power of x. Okay? You have to be a little bit careful there because you have to sort of think about things now being defined on a multi-sheeted cover of the complex plane, but everything otherwise works. And that gets you all other values of q. Okay? So remember, q was sort of physical parameter in the six-vertex model. And you recover all of that. Okay? Also, it was a little bit fiddly that I had twisted boundary conditions. Well, shortly after the original work on this, Batanov, Lukyanov, and Zanlodikov pointed out that you could add in an angular momentum term to my differential equations, okay, and all the arguments basically still go through, okay, but it changes the twist. Okay, it changes these little phase factors in the TQ election, and you can recover information about all the other fields in the theory. There are some special cases of this, which are also quite fun to look at. So, for example, if I set now, so this has now become 2m here, you might think, well, something special is going to happen when m is equal to 1, right? Because that corresponds to just a simple harmonic oscillator. That ought to be something simple in the integral model world, and indeed it is. It's actually what's called the free fermion point of the 6-watt vertex model, okay, where everything basically becomes trivial. Okay, so it's quite nice that that's related to simple harmonic oscillator. Another simple case is you can set m equals to 1/2, okay, because then that just becomes linear here. And then this whole, the eigenvalue problem in some sense becomes a bit trivial, because you can absorb E into a shift in X and solve these equations using Airy functions. And that turns out to be a very special point from the point of the integral model as well. It's the point where something called delta, well, okay, this is point Q is E to the 2 pi over 3, which is a point where all sorts of miracles in the nature of the Baker-Amberstadt solution occur, which was discovered relatively recently by Razumov and Stroganov. And so this also seems to be an interesting connection. Okay. So I say there are various other directions you can take this as well. But I think I should conclude. Well, I should maybe also mention that the Baker-Amberstadt system that I spoke about is, well, actually, if I'm going to mention it, let's just do it. So the conclusion is, first of all, that at least in some cases, there's this concrete link via the Baker-Amberstadt and these TQ relations and so on between two naively very separated bits of mathematical physics. Okay? The spectral problem of finding ground states in the integral and quantum field theories, and a spectral problem in this sort of funny quantum mechanics problem. Okay, and a spin-off of that was this reality proof I just showed you for the quantum mechanics. So whether you want to use that then to decide that you should replace all the quantum mechanics with non-Hermitian quantum mechanics is up to you. And also actually practically, from the point of view of people who are doing, say, problems in condensed matter, well, they actually quite often want to know what these T and Q functions actually are. Okay? So they've got some fancy procedure which is related to some physical observable in your integral model or whatever to a value taken by a T and Q function. It turns out it's rather convenient. You know, computers are quite good at solving ordinary differential equations. So if you've got a specification of these T's and Q's as just Wronskians between particular solutions of differential equations, it's actually quite practical for computing using these methods. Plus, it gives you a very nice analytical handle on the properties of the function, because you know, people have been studying ordinary differential equations for years. And the story goes rather further. So first of all, I kind of brushed this a bit under the rug, but we were talking about always the ground state of the integral model here. And that's a little bit related to the fact that in my Hermitian version of this problem, all the eigenvalues were real, okay? Which, if you sort of decode everything, translates into all the beta roots being real, which is characteristic of a ground state. But it's turned out that it's possible to have more complicated potentials. These were invented by, again, Batanov, Lukyanov, and Zanlodikov. They call them monstrous potentials, where you add in a whole bunch of further terms here, subject to some constraint. And that gets you other states in these things. Okay? You can discuss Beta-Amberstadt systems related to other, so secretly the 6th vertex Beta-Amberstadt is related to SU2. You can discuss Beta-Amberstadt systems relating to other algebras, and at that point the sort of Schrodinger connection kind of goes away. It turns out you have to take, for example, higher order differential equations. But there are still well-defined spectral problems associated with these, which you can map onto the whole Beta-Amberstadt technology. Okay, and even there are some cases where people don't yet know about a Beta-Amberstadt. So there's something called the paperclip blip. Brain, sort of D-brain, that was studied by Zanlodikov and Lukyanov at some point. And there they found a differential equation which was associated with the system. So they took that as a sign of integrability, even though they couldn't find the Beta-Amberstadt solution. And finally, the sort of recent news, and one of the reasons why it's justified to talk about this again, is that there seems to be a sort of generalization. This is sort of fitting into a rather bigger picture now. So there's work, for example, that Pedro and collaborators have been working on gauge theory scattering amplitude, which set up other sorts of problems, but in some sense still sort of classical problems to do with Stokes phenomenon and so on, where, again, links with functional relations associated with integral models crop up. And in fact, that's, from our point of view, extremely nice, because one of the limitations of what we had was we always ended up looking at a conformal field theory, okay? So in some sense of a theory of zero mass. But the whole technology of Baxter and of BLV and all that also encompasses cases where the conformal field theories have massive excitation, well, they're no longer conformal field theories, but they have massive excitation associated with them. And that has an effect on the analytic properties of these T and Q functions, which we were not able to reproduce just looking at simple Schrodinger-type equations of the sort that we had. We kind of scratched our heads and really didn't get very far with that. But now, luckily, other people have come along, and it seems like there's a whole sort of generalization, as I say, of all of this story, involved with that. And well, you have some people locally who are good people to ask about all that, and I'll be asking them about it more in the next few days as well. But anyway, I think that's quite an interesting development. It seems to be a sort of growing theme. In some ways, this is like the simplest possible example. If you want to understand how these sorts of things work, then maybe first understand about Stokes phenomenon in this context, and then you're ready to go on and look at more complicated and exciting examples relating to things like string theory and stuff. Okay, that's all I want to say.
Yeah, so in the end, you said you could generalize it by using it over M, but M had to be a natural number, right? By generalizing the potential, yes.
No, it doesn't. No.
It doesn't.
No. But then, as I mentioned very briefly, you have to be a little bit careful there, because obviously then your potential is not single valued.
Yeah.
So what you do is you introduce a branch cut. Okay. And then actually, so you've given me a slight excuse for one more thing, which is that if M is still rational, then the thing will still close itself up after a finite number of turns around. And that turns out to be related to this truncation business I mentioned happening in fusion hierarchies when Q was the root of unity. So that being rational is the same as Q being the root of unity. And then everything sort of closes up when you go around a finite number of times. Okay, and that then will lead on to this underlying of aggregateness and so on as well.
Can you give more details about what is the limit at the bit and that's that you need to take like your bit and that's? Because it's not the usual XXC bit and that's, as you mentioned in the slide, right hand side is different, right?
Yeah, that's right. You have to take, basically you're taking the thermodynamic limit. Okay, so you have to take the number of sets off infinity. And roughly speaking, what's happening is that you're looking, if you know about how these roots tend to behave, normally you'll have a sort of, well, you can think about defining sort of density of the number of beta roots as a function of E or whatever we're dealing with. Okay. And what happens is that if you take the system size very large and you focus on just the sort of edge of that distribution, which is kind of determining the next corrections in the entries of some of the states, okay, then it turns out, so you can take a sort of consistent limit as you move out in such a way that these factors which are not generally equal to 1 become equal to 1. And that's the limit that we're dealing with here. Okay. So it's basically just the limit where N, the number of sites, is 10 to the infinity. You have to take that limit.
And the small e's are very large.
And
the small e's are very large. So
that's right, yeah. So you sort of ship rescale the e's just look on one edge of the distribution. If you look in the middle, it's kind of boring. You just get this sort of fixed number, which is the density. Okay? But these e's retain a non-trivial spacing off at the edge of the distribution, which you can study. That turns out to be an important thing when you're studying the finite size effects in your lattice model in this continuum unit, or studying the subsequent.
You mentioned kind of tongue in cheek that now you can do quantum mechanics with a complex potential.
Yeah.
But so that raises a mathematical question. Are these eigenfunctions complete?
Yeah, I don't fully know the answer to that. I'm not, in some sense, I'm treating the reality property as just an amusing mathematical physics problem. So I'm not going to hang my seminar on whether this works or not. I think Carl Bender is the person who's worked a lot on this, and there's evidence for completeness, but I don't quite know how it's phrased, and I don't know quite what the right inner product to use and so on is. Okay. And it's just, and there are also, I should maybe mention, there are regimes when the spectrum ceases to be real. So once I've allowed this, so let's keep with the second order case, but have a general power here. Okay. Once you let that become less than 1, it turns out that the spectrum does become complex. Because it's quite a subtle business what's going on here. You have many, many eigenvalues sort of pinch together and become complex as M goes through and similar, as this goes through. So at M equals, by the way, at M equals 1, it's just a simple, even with the back of I here, it is just a simple harmonic oscillator, that everything is trivial. And bigger than 1 spectrum, so and less than 1 spectrum is actually complex.
Can I ask the question earlier? I think I give you some differential equation like that.
Yeah.
How would you know, say, like that? I give you some differential equation.
Yeah.
How do you know whether there's an associated integral system making
at the moment? I don't. Okay. I mean, these particular ones which map onto these sorts of problems have rather nice properties in terms of rotation. Essentially, so what you notice that rather symmetrical five-fold figure that I have. It can have rather nice symmetrical properties with respect to those rotations in the complex plane, which help make the whole thing work. Okay. On the other hand, it's general approach. So I don't really know whether in general it'll map onto a known digital model. But this general approach of extracting functional relations and trying to make them closed and then turning that into integral equations does seem to work more generally. Okay, so as an alternative approach to eigenvalue problems, which is in some sense sort of a little bit more perturbative than exact, for general polynomial potentials, you can make some progress. Okay, but I don't know from generally whether there's a complete dictionary with other integral models.
Let me ask again more or less the same question. So if you have the usual x-axis in chain with some finite number of sides and you want the usual bit equations, can you...
Okay, so... tough question. So in that case, it's not known, again, apart from at one special point. So there's, I mentioned in the last transparent input one that when this power was equal to 1, everything was particularly simple. So when the power is equal to 1, this differential equation was possible. Well, in that case, you can actually define a sort of modified version of the equation which seems to correspond to the finite lattice case. Okay?
And then excited states correspond to when singularities to the potential.
Yeah, that's right. But that's a different case. So the excited states can happen in general, okay, not just at that special point. That can be done in general. That is these monstrous potentials. So there's a lot of unsolved problems associated with that, because essentially... the way that the equation for the excited states behave is somehow encoding everything that you ever knew about the Virasoro algebra, its null vectors, all that sort of stuff. But the way that that actually works is completely not understood. There's a nice problem of properties of these generalized potentials and the Virasoro algebra and so on to solve there. But there's also an unsolved problem trying to find a similar thing. It's very tempting. For example, you might, people when we were first doing this were suggesting that you might try and make a discrete version of this differential equation to correspond to a finite lattice, but no one's been able to make that fly. Then when you take the infinite lattice from the point of view of your integral model, this turns into a continuous differential equation here. But as far as I know, no one's managed to make that actually work. But it's tempting to think there should be something like that going on somewhere.
I was just curious, do you know how experimentally you measure this ground state entropy in a virus? Is it the primary contribution to the entropy?
I think they just cool it down. I can't remember. In the paper, I think they just sort of cool it down a lot and measure. I'm not going to give you any very good answer, but it is experimentally measured. You have to cool it very close to zero.
So this was a long time ago. But they could get,
Right. And then, of course, you can also, and I think, they also do just numerics. We'll have to find out what the numbers are. So the real coordination structure of ice as well as with square ice. If you could find an exact answer to that, you would be happy, but in some sense that's to do with high dimensional integrability, so it's not easy to be done.
You alluded to
the McNugget problem is, but I won't quite tell you how it's got to do with this.
Okay.
The idea is that McNuggets come in boxes of sizes, I don't want to tell you, it's 6, 9, and 11, or something like that. So and the question is, how many McNuggets can you not have? Okay, so like you can't have 3 McNuggets because your smallest box is size 6. Okay, but you also can't have 7, and you can't have 6 plus something from the second box. So that there's sort of 5, and well, the context here is that, well, I was trying to, what needs to do is, it's actually associated with this attempt to unwrap the Riemann surface. Okay, so I told you this truncation phenomenon is associated with the surface on which we need to find. For a rational value of M being a finite cover of the complex plane. Okay? You can try and do a variable transformation to make everything more explicit, where it becomes just a single cover of the complex plane. And then you'd like for monodromy properties of solutions to your differential equation to behave simply. And it turns out that what you have to do is you also have to carry along this 1 over x squared factor. And there's a simple little mathematical problem associated with whether you have a trivial monodromy or not around the origin, which turns out to be equivalent to this McNugget problem in terms of classifying the possible solutions to it. Okay? And that in turn means that every time you do have a solution to it, there's a finite number of boxes, nuggets that you cannot have. Okay? And that turns out to exactly match to the set of primary fields in these mineral models of conformal field theory, so the sort of equivalent between that and the problem of classifying the quantum field and the quantum field theory, which is kind of somehow gives you an alternative explanation and links up with the Katz formula.
I don't think that was an invention at all, but you asked. So 43 apparently is the smallest number that you, but the larger number you cannot.
Right. Yeah. Apparently, if you have so for us actually, it's just a two box, not like a problem. So they ran out of box in size six or something. But, apparently, so it's actually if you want to go to more boxes, it's quite a big area of problems. You can see out from the top.
Any questions? Let's thank Patrick again.